Hi everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Now and Men, the podcast on men, masculinities, and gender equality. I'm Stephen Burrell, and I'm here with my co-host, Sandy Ruxton. Did you have a good Easter break, Sandy?
I did, Stephen, thank you very much. It was actually my birthday on Good Friday, so to celebrate, I went cycling on the Isle of Wight with friends of mine, which was lovely. But tell me, were you bought a chocolate egg by the Easter Bilby, which I believe delivers in Australia?
Thank you, Sandy. Yes, and happy birthday to you as well. Yes, I was delivered a chocolate egg. Yeah, I have previously had a chocolate bilby as well, but as I believe is the tradition in Australia. But I didn't have one of them this year, but there was an egg, so that was very nice. Yes, and for those of you who don't know what a bilby is, it's a very cute nocturnal marsupial here in Australia, but it is sadly endangered, so I haven't actually seen a real one alive yet, as opposed to a chocolate one. But anyway, this is all tangential to our episode today, which we should get on with. So we're delighted to be here talking to Dr. Ken Harland, who's been involved in youth work practice and research with boys and young men in Northern Ireland over the past 35 years. So Ken joined Ulster University in 1996 and was the co-founder and co-director of the Centre for Young Men's Studies there from 2005 to 2016. And since then, he's been working independently as a consultant, trainer, lecturer, and researcher in youth and youth-related issues. And he also currently works part-time as a research fellow and consultant with Ulster University's longitudinal research initiative, Taking Boys Seriously.
So, Ken, welcome to Now and Men. Given our international audience, perhaps we thought we should start by saying something about the Northern Ireland context. Now, many of our listeners will have heard of the Troubles, the violent sort of sectarian conflict from about 1968 to 1998 between the Protestant Unionists or Loyalists who wanted the province to remain part of the UK and the Roman Catholic Nationalists or Republicans who wanted Northern Ireland to become part of the Republic of Ireland. Obviously, this was a particularly brutal conflict, but a peaceful solution was reached in 1998 through the Good Friday Agreement, which involved the governments of both the UK and Ireland and both communities in the north. There's obviously a lot more to this than this brief outline can give, but perhaps we could start by asking you a little bit about your own experience over this period. How was it for you, Ken, to live through the Troubles, and how do you feel about what's happening in Northern Ireland now, 25-plus years on?
Well, thank you, Sandy and Stephen, for the invite. Looking back over the Troubles, I was a teenager at the time the Troubles were started, and really at that time, Northern Ireland was quite a safe place. Growing up for me, it was all about, I grew up in inner city, East Belfast. It was playing in the streets, it was having friends, and then all of a sudden, it just seemed as if one day everything changed. And, an example I could give of that was, I played a lot of football growing up, and part of the team I played for, there were Protestants and Catholics in it. And in my own community, it just seemed like you woke up one morning and these guys from the Catholic community had actually been put out of the community, like literally the night before. And that for me was like just the sharp end. My goodness, life has changed here in Northern Ireland. And it did change, and just them friends gone. I never seen them again in my life. And their houses were actually burnt at the time, but it was a very stark message that things will never be the same in Northern Ireland. And that led me into, just a period of that just seemed to be the way life became everyday life for everybody in Northern Ireland, where violence and threat of violence was just an everyday occasion. And I grew up as a young boy in that era, as many people did. And as I was growing up, a lot of my friends and school friends, some joined paramilitaries, some later on in their life were actually killed in various ways. So it was a very brutal, for me, period of adolescence, becoming a young man in a society at conflict. And thank goodness, thank God, that now we are in a period of moving towards peace building. But there is legacies come from the conflict in Northern Ireland that still remain. There's still stubborn issues that haven't gone away, and we see that there, the struggles of peace building. But our society has changed, and it's a different world. And I think people now have hope for the future. But I suppose where my a lot of my work has been is actually, you know, thinking from my own experiences of being a boy growing up in the city area and seeing how these areas that, you know, struggle through the brunt of troubles still try to transition into peace. And I think it's difficult in a lot of communities and for a lot of people.
Mm. I mean, you talk about the transition there. You know, to what extent do you think gender has been part of the conversation about transition, political transition, or has that tended to be sort of marginalised?
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at the troubles in Northern Ireland, it's actually, it was and probably still probably remains primarily a story about men. Men who were previously breadwinners. If you look at Northern Ireland's a massive industrial history. You know, we were leading in rope building, linen and shipbuilding. And as you know, the Titanic was built in Belfast. So there's that. And I always like to throw in that the ship was okay when it left Belfast, you know, just to get that right. Men's identity was really cemented a lot around men as workers. You know, in the shipyard in the 1950s, there's 35,000 men worked in the shipyard, and today there's 100, maybe wow. maybe less. So at the one side of the trouble, there's also like a moving away from industrial, the post-industrial society. There was a lot of issues around, you know, things like social issues around poverty. In Northern Ireland, you know, still, you know, it's the highest poverty levels in the UK and lots of places in Europe as well. It's the highest levels. 25% of young people here grew up in poverty. So while the troubles dominate, there was a lot of social issues as well, running parallel with that there, which made it, you know, a difficult place to grow up in, and I think a difficult place for men, you know, who were traditionally workers, and what the troubles brought about was the fact that these men now, a lot of men became more like, you know, defenders and of their communities and seeing themselves as protectors. And so gender wasn't really, in a sense, critiqued in that sense. It was really driven by men and men's issues and the violence and, you know, boys becoming soldiers at a very young age. And so gender as a focus wasn't really at the fore of that. But a lot of my work and colleagues I work with was a lot of, you know, feminist women, strong women, women leaders. And, you know, I've been part of many teams and I've been leader of teams and organizations with very strong women with feminist views, which has really influenced me in my life and help me check me at times as well. You know, I worked along with my colleague Susan Morgan for 30 years, and she worked as part of a gender unit and a youth organization I was in. When I joined that organization, because of my journey, I was able to work in there and help set up a young men's unit to complement that. So I've always been aware of gender growing up, but I think general society, it wasn't really open and discussed, and the role of women was really set forward in that context. Mm.
You mentioned a minute ago that during the period of the conflict, men tended to operate as defenders and protectors. I think those were your words. Do you want to say a little bit more about what you mean by defenders and protectors?
Yes, I think that people viewed their communities as under threat, and therefore, particularly in the early years of the Troubles, it was like every mom was expected to contribute to that. You know, you got people who maybe didn't join our paramilitaries, they still maybe became vigilantes, keeping their watch over the community. And there was a real sense of, the danger and threat coming from the other community. And from other paramilitaries. And like I lived in a loyalist area, which is interesting because see, just before trouble started, what we had in Belfast, I don't know if it was in other parts of Ireland, but certainly in Belfast, was these things called, they were called tartan gangs, were separate communities, even within loyalist communities. There was maybe, you know, four or five different types of tartan gang. And there was a lot of sort of violence underpinning that. And, you know, it was like community against community, even though they were all maybe from loyalist backgrounds. But whenever the trouble started, lots of that energy and those young men actually transitioned into paramilitaries and joined paramilitaries. And, you know, I could give you lots of stories. I remember one night coming home, I used to drive a motorbike, and I was coming home to the state where I lived, and I was stopped in the road by the paramilitaries. They were balaclavas, and, you know, they were, at times, they were like army clothing and stuff, and I was stopped. But this guy, and he stopped me and says, "Who are you and where are you going?" And I knew who it was, because I'd went to school with him, and I said to myself, you know, so I'll not use his name, but I said, "Hey, Joe, I'm Ken here." And it was, "Don't talk to me like that." You know, so it was like a complete change of his personality and whatever. But his identity then became that he was like a soldier defending his communities, and he had to do this here sort of role. But it was, as a young boy, teenager, come and say at that time, maybe 16, 17, you just saying to yourself, "My goodness, you know, our world has changed here, and these people actually see themselves as soldiers defending their communities, and they're prepared in many cases to die for this, you know." So it was quite a sense of protection and defender. And sometimes if you weren't one of those, you actually maybe felt a wee bit as if you were, you know, not quite doing your role or whatever for your society.
It feels like there was a sort of cult of the hard man, you know, around as well, and that must have been quite influential.
Yes,
young men as they were growing up.
Well, when I work with young men, I would always use the term, you know, and sometimes I've, you know, done presentations about, you know, acting tough, and just, you know, saying that how young men, you know, their identities are formed and shaped by acting tough, you know, and that manifests itself in so many different ways. I think it affected boys growing up, how they communicate. It affected boys in school. You know, that the boys, in some sort of ways, you know, I think teachers sometimes don't realize how this happened in schools affected boys, you know, and the whole sort of masculinity that I would have seen acting tough was boys prepared to stand up to teachers. Boys, you know, teachers sometimes talk about conflict with boys, and across, you know, I think teachers across the UK at the minute are struggling a lot with the aggression coming forward, maybe from boys, and teachers find it very difficult. And I've worked with educators and youth workers, and, you know, they all say that they do find it, you know, very challenging working with boys and their behaviour. And when I talk to boys, they turn around and they would say to you things like, "Well, no teacher's going to talk to me like that. They're not going to talk down to me just because I'm maybe not one of their favourites or whatever." And they're prepared to stand up, stand off. It's all, you know, examples of boys feeling that they need to act tough. And, you know, much research around masculinity, you know, boys mask their emotions, and, you know, they come across sometimes as unemotional. But thankfully, in my own work as a youth worker, over the many years, I find it just having opportunities, giving boys opportunities just to talk. I mean, it sounds so simple, but it's so radical. My whole life's been an evidence of these boys growing up in, say, for instance, inner city communities, marginalised. They feel that they're labelled as disadvantaged, they're labelled underachievers. And yet whenever you talk to these boys and listen to their stories, they open up and they're prepared to take the mask off and say, you know, "This is who I am." So that, because I can identify so much with that in my own life and my own sort of adolescence, I really from start early my career felt, listen, I'm going to become a voice for these boys, and I'm going to give them opportunities to talk and to share what their lives, the reality of their lives, the nitty gritty aspects of their lives, and bring that to youth work practice, to start challenging formal education, to think about how they engage boys and work boys and what they offer to them. So that became a real driving force in my life. And, you know, that led me from a boy leaving school at 14 in an inner city. And that passion in my 20s and thinking about this and getting involved in youth work training, becoming a professional youth worker, and actually working in communities, and spent my years in different communities, but all communities that were like, you know, were boys living in inner city areas, and just trying to give them a voice to speak through.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting what you're saying, because a lot of what you're talking about, I could kind of recognise from other contexts as well, about, you know, boys shielding their emotions and not having a voice and feeling marginalised and so on and so forth. But of course, in the context of Northern Ireland and the Troubles, there were other additional things to deal with. So the, you know, the normalising of violence, for example, you know, and some of the policing, if you can call it that, which probably could have amounted to sort of punishment, beating, shootings, all of that kind of thing going on for young men, as well as a result of paramilitary activity. I mean, there's a sort of interesting balance between, you know, what was happening elsewhere in, you know, UK or US, Australia, wherever, and what was happening in Northern Ireland was very different in some ways.
Yes, I think as we've moved away towards peace building, that what we're finding here is a lot of what was maybe normal crime and violence in the UK and maybe in other parts of the world as well began to come into Northern Ireland. What we also have at the minute is paramilitaries, they disbanded and they had ceasefires, but they haven't gone away, as a famous saying was once in Northern Ireland, and they're still there. And paramilitaries now, you know, are involved more in criminality, and we can see that. But there's the sinister side of paramilitaries is always the fact that it was exploiting young people. It was exploiting particularly young men, you know. And today there's even evidence now that paramilitaries are involved in drugs, and that sex exploitation and different things like that there. And young people are still being victimised by paramilitaries. That's been taken to the UK government and spoke about that. So them issues, in many ways, I think paramilitaries found it difficult to give up control. And a lot of these people, you know, whose identities are cemented through work and status. Paramilitaries give a lot of young men status, and a lot of older men as well, who had lost the provider sort of role with their family, the worker, in this, and it has been hard to give up. So yes, we still have that threat and that fear, and people still fear to leave their communities, to go to certain places. Everyone in Northern Ireland knows where they feel safe and where you can't go. You know, all these underlying tones are there. But increasingly now we're seeing more, you know, signs of other forms of what would have been normal violence in other places coming here now. And our society is undoubtedly changing.
Mm. And presumably also going with that was a sort of a distrust of the police and the army and et cetera, you know. That it wasn't just paramilitaries, there were all kinds of different groups that you had to beware of.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's right. But I think what for young men is this confusion about law and order and where law and order comes from. Because in these communities, paramilitaries still retain the power, and they still, they shout, you know, the punishment. Like there's times whenever I worked with boys 15, 16, 17 who were told by paramilitaries they were to turn up at a certain place at a certain time because of what activities they'd been up to in the community. And these boys would have went to there and ended up getting some sort of level of, as you call it, punishment for that there. And yes, there are other forms of violence. I mean, you know, the contrasting thing is people who come to Northern Ireland all say how friendly the people are and they love it here and it's a beautiful country, and so it is. But there's this sort of, I think, resilience from Northern Ireland people, and that their sense of humour, and that they're able to just have come through the experiences of what was a war, and still retain some sort of sense of, person, of openness, of friendliness, and just trying to be decent people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering how you feel, Ken, about the situation now. I mean, yeah, do you feel, is there a lot of optimism and hope for the future? I mean, I know there's been a lot of issues in recent years, hasn't there, through Brexit, a lot of political turmoil. But at the same time, maybe things have changed. There have been women leaders of the kind of major political parties, for example. So there have been clearly some shifts in gender relations. How are you feeling about the situation now in Northern Ireland and how the future is looking?
Yes, feeling much more positive. And I think there's a sense here that our society is changing. And I think also that there's something hopeful for Northern Ireland, for other countries, even if you look at wars now in Ukraine and Gaza, and all those things are going on across the world in other contexts. And I do think in many ways that Northern Ireland has a message of hope for other communities, because we've come through that. We have a devolved government here, power sharing and at government. But you see, the other side is, in the last 10 years, our devolved government here has only been together for 3 years. 7 of those 10 years, either one party has come out and stopped and says, no, we're not happy about this. And then just recently, up until literally 2 months ago, our government wasn't sitting because of one party not happy about different things. Brexit, has affected us here as well. The cost of living, there's all sorts of, people here deal with everyday things just the same as the UK, Australia, or anywhere across Europe. But there is a sense that things are different, that there's the potential here for our politicians to work together. And I do think that women have played an important role, and probably under-recognized or under-acknowledged role. During the Troubles, it was all about men, but there was a women's coalition formed to say, listen, women can be strong. We can be strong as peace builders and peacemakers and peace sustainers. And they set up a party that doesn't exist now, but it did. It was helpful at that time. And I think it also gave a different perspective than just the male perspective, which was very strong, dominant, no surrender, we don't give up, we don't budge. Where women brought a softer balance. They still said powerful things, but not in the same tones as the men. And I think that in communities, women were very good at articulating the vulnerabilities of individuals, particularly their sons, and how it impacted in sons and daughters and moms and dads, who were saying, like my mum told me when I went out at nights during the trouble, she said she couldn't sleep until she heard the motorbike coming up the drive at maybe 12:30 or 1 in the morning, but she always feared, is he going to be okay? And I think lots of mums felt that, and I do think women were particularly that well. But also run alongside the Troubles and run alongside, men's studies and masculinity debates, which was tremendous. I think that feminist women here in Northern Ireland locally were saying a lot to challenge men, to challenge action. But I don't think it was coming across in academic debates and academic writings as strongly as it maybe is beginning to now. And, I know women now who write and feed into that there, and, people who worked in the university, professors and women's, and who have now begin to articulate that there and challenge men. But also the work that we do with boys, it's not just all about young men just saying we understand and we know that maybe you struggle to show emotions. It's about helping young men and challenging young men to see how they are contributing to a lot of oppression and inequalities and sexism, and we challenge that, and boys and the people who we train at Ulster University become youth workers working in these communities. We make them aware that gender becomes a big part of what we teach. And myself and my colleague run a module for years on gender.
Yeah, because I can imagine in lots of ways women and girls must have borne the brunt of the conflict, you know, in terms of like the consequence of this very masculinized culture and very violent, you know, things like domestic abuse in the home and so on. Yeah,
well, domestic violence is a massive factor in Northern Ireland, so it is, and we've lots of women's groups and women's support groups and women activists, you know, so women are there and they've always been there, and I think they're growing stronger, and they've influenced this society massively over the last 30 years. There's no doubt about that. And while my I'm talking today completely about talking about boys and young men, I've worked in an organization which was a gender unit, you know. I worked with girls and young women throughout my career as well, but my research focus, and I suppose my passion, was just to help a better understanding of how boys' lives and what they're experiencing. When I first joined the youth service, it was all about diversionary work, about recreation, about trying to keep boys off the streets. And the research I was doing, talking to boys, and I got the opportunity to do a PhD while I worked full-time. So I was working with these boys in communities over a 5-year period and really building up knowledge and beginning to try and articulate that through the way I wrote about it, and I got opportunities to do that there, which to me is such a privilege. And being a youth worker in a local community, it gives you tremendous unique access to these very people who are struggling so much, yet they don't get the opportunity to talk about their lives.
So you've told us a little bit, Ken, about your career and how it kind of developed. But yeah, I suppose one thing I was interested in was what led you to kind of focusing on these issues of men and masculinities in your work in the first place. I mean, that must have kind of felt somewhat like you were going against the norm, I would imagine, at the time. And maybe it was even quite risky, I would guess, in some ways. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, I can remember whenever I was working with boys and talking about that, I have sort of stayed in education my whole life. I'm a real believer in lifelong education. I didn't actually start going to school until I was, you know, higher education until I was 28. So I hadn't really got a background in education. But I had a friend, and he was a lecturer. And one day, I'd known him for years, he just says to me, "Ken, you know, I think you would love education if you get into that. You really would." And he just planted a seed in me, and that seed sort of became a spark. And I can remember, you know, I can remember going to do two what we would call O-levels or GCSEs in a college. And over a year, while I worked in other jobs before I came into youth work, obviously. I actually worked in the shipyard for a while. But those type of jobs, I'm actually done well in that there. And I applied, I started doing voluntary work in organisations who worked with young people who were on the margins in society. And I started working with them. I actually, believe it or not, although I'd left school at 14, we were teaching English language to them, which was, I can always remember going to that there with my dictionary, the how to spell the words when they were saying to me, you know, writing stories and things like that, and I couldn't spell the word. So education became like a hunger for me, and I really, and still do to this day, enjoy that. But I always had this passion for how I would talk to people and give them spaces for the talk and try and get, you know, the truth of where they're at and try and probe in that and trying to learn how to ask good questions at the right time and the right way to get answers from boys and get beyond shrugs and yes and no and okay, the more thoughtful answers from them. And I was bringing this into my studies, and I was sitting in a classroom one day talking about this to a lecturer, and he said to me, you know, he said, "See what you've just said to me there?" He said, "This was in 1996. he said to me, there's a PhD in that. I didn't even know what a PhD was. And I said, right. But through time, that stayed with me. And I'd done a short piece of research as a, you know, a dissertation and around that subject. And it just led on from that there. I began to connect, sort of, if you like, theory and academic thinking to my practice. And throughout my life, I have lived this, like, research-informed practices. The term I'd use myself, and I read that somewhere to stay with me, is like a pracademic. So the practice is at my heart, but the academia is as well, and they just fit together. It's never been one or the other. But I have to say that, you know, the fellow who said to me, the friend, you know, the guy in the room who said to me about his PhD in that, women I have worked with who've talked to me about gender, people who have encouraged me in staff teams, role models, men who were very gender conscious, and they had background and history and knowledge around masculinity and men. I was so hungry getting that from them, and the PhD, it all just fed into me, and it probably molded me into that. So research and practice, and obviously opportunity to train students in a university who came from similar, a lot of community workers apply for these jobs, and they're like myself, they're coming from communities where young people are growing up, and they have everyday experience of what they're experiencing now in society. So the masculinities came from that there, and I was able to connect that to my own life, to even my own relationship with my father. It really made me think about my relationship with my dad, and he worked in the shipyard 35 years. He never worked anywhere else. And, you know, he seen that was his role, you know, nothing other than that. Or he would have worked and then had a few pints at the weekend, and sometimes a few pints too many on many occasions. But that was his life. And, you know, I can remember even, you know, my dad, you know, I spoke to him about, you know, masculinity and summer work and stuff. He never really got it, but I told him, I said, Dad, you know, a lot of boys really struggle, you know, with their identity and when they become men and how they become men and who teaches them to become men. And while my dad didn't teach me masculinity, in some sort of sense, he did, but a lot of it I rejected, you know, as, no, well, that's not the way I am and stuff like that there. But I remember when I was like maybe 16 or 17, my dad, he says to me, I want you to come up to the wee pub. It was up at the top of our street. And I one night the same year, and I come up, and this was quite a powerful moment for me as a rite of passage. He says, I come in, he says, Ken, I'm going to buy you a pint of Guinness. I said, right. And honestly, I mean, don't get me wrong, I used to have wee beers sneaked about, you know, the house, like just any teenager would have done, but I'd never really sat in a pub or anything. And he ordered me this pint of Guinness, and I'll be honest with you, when I first tasted that, I said, mate, that stuff absolutely stinks. But as I matured and got older, I began to appreciate how nice the odd pint of Guinness can be, you know, and with a lovely head on it. It is one of life's little pleasures, I suppose. But that moment for me with my dad, and I shared that with him as well, you know, about how much that meant to me, just my dad saying, Ken, there's a pint. And when I was doing the studies around men masculinity as well, I think it made who I am as a husband. Now I'm married, just 40th wedding anniversary this year, you know. I think it made me appreciate my wife and the role and my role and my children and my grandchildren, you know. I think I bring every part of what my learning is applied, you know. It's not just a theoretical concept. I try to live that there and be a man that I want to be, and that a man that I think is a positive role model to everyone, whether it's a man or woman or a child, a male, female, it doesn't matter to me. But I try to project that. So it's not just theoretical, I suppose, of what I'm saying. And the other thing I did with my dad, I can remember he used to stay down the caravan in the summer, and he loved it down there. And I got this terrible urge just to go down and see him one day. And I drove down, And I went in, and Metallic is a very traditional man, you know, in many, many, many ways. He wouldn't have been emotional anyway. I said, Dad, I'm going to tell you something. And he says to me, what is it, Carl? And I says, Dad, do you know that I love you? And here he is, Kent, yeah, of course I do. He says, well, what do you mean, Dad? I says, well, Dad, I just wanted you to hear it from me, you know, because I don't think I've ever told you that before. And again, that was just an example of how I would try and just be the person that I'm becoming through what I was learning, what I was learning from boys, what I was learning from work, from colleagues in work.
Yeah, well, we mentioned in the introduction that you co-founded the Centre for Young Men's Studies at Ulster University back in 2005 with Sam McCready. I mean, there aren't many research centres like that out there. So, yeah, could you tell us a little bit about how that came about and how your joint work there developed through your career?
Yes, I mean, the Centre for Young Men's Studies came about, you know, sort of like nearly inadvertently. Sam and I applied for a grant to Joseph Rowntree Trust, and they came back to us and they said, listen, we'd like you to do some work about boys' lives and boys' experiences and some of the stuff that we've talked about. And we put in an application and we received that. They gave us a healthy grant. And it was at that time, it was just like born. We talked about the need and for boys and how we're going to go about this subject. And the centre was never something we planned, and it just seemed to come about. And one day we woke up and we were a centre for young men's studies, and we stuck a label on the door. And then eventually the university started calling us that. So it ran in that capacity for about 11 years. And I would say that it really was trying to bring a more rigorous academic lens to the work and the practice that we did as community youth workers. And I think that people like Joseph Rowntree Trust actually, when they spoke to us, believed in us, and they could see our passion and you know, the drive that we had to try and create something solid that was studying and looking into boys and trying to bring answers to this. So we set the centre up, and we were doing a lot of research and writing about boys and violence and boys growing up in communities and boys being alienated and boys struggling in school. And we applied at that time for another grant, and we actually got a grant from the Department of Education and the Department of Justice to look at boys' experiences of education and their life experiences in Northern Ireland. And they give us, you know, a significant amount of money. And that's what started to taking boys seriously. So we've done a 5-year longitudinal study with 400 boys, almost 400 boys over a 5-year period. And at the very end, we didn't know what we called the river, but when we got it finished, we called it Taking Boys Seriously. And we loved that title. We were sitting with a steering group, and at the end of the study with all this data in front of us, and we didn't know what to call it. And just out of that there bubble, it just came them three words, Taking Boys Seriously. So that there was quite fundamental. And what as a result of that there, we got a lot of schools coming on board with that there. We seemed to be disseminating the work for about 18 months, really, going in and out of schools. And there were certain schools, I'd say like the Boys Model in Northern Ireland, who applied a lot of the findings in that study and really transformed their school through it, and the results, and people going on to higher education and university. So that had an impact, but it didn't bring about the systemic change that's needed when dealing with boys and education attainment is a stubborn issue. And one of the things where, you know, that I think hampers that is the fact that it's often brought down simply to, if you listen every year, it's the girls versus boys, the girls are doing this and boys doing that. But we've come up with this term, compounded education disadvantage, as a way of looking at gender and how these boys are coming from communities coming out of the Troubles, where there's high levels of poverty, and all these social factors are what is actually impacting these boys' lives. So we try to see that. It helped us identify which boys are we talking about now. It becomes brings clarity to the whole research, which is being embedded in communities. So it's very rewarding for me to be part of that project, because I left Ulster full time in 2016. I thought I was going to go on this sailing into this new life and things for me. But what ends up is four grandchildren came along, and my wife retired, and we've actually become childminders in a sense. So 2 days a week, and the cost of childminding, you know that yourself. So 2 days a week, my wife and I look after four grandchildren, and so I have a day a week with Ulster, 2 days with my grandchildren, and that's how my life is patterned out from that phase.
I mean, it feels like the construction of masculinities has been a real sort of central theme in your work. You know, you talked about it powerfully in relation to your relationship with your dad, but also in relation to the work in schools. So, you know, how boys become men, their public, their private worlds, the contradictions between their sort of perceived sense of power and their sense of powerlessness. Do you want to say a bit more about the construction of masculinities and what you've learned through all this work that you've done over the years?
Yeah, I suppose when I think about it, I do feel that it has actually helped me to become a better researcher, a better academic, a better practitioner, a better father, a better son, you know, a better husband, a better grandfather, you know. So that's how I view that there. And I still feel that my PhD was called the Men and Masculinities, the Construction of Masculine Identities in Inner City Belfast. And that there, you know, I do think the local context is really important. While I focused on Northern Ireland, Inner City Belfast, in my writing, this connects everywhere. You know, men and from different ethnic groups and different backgrounds, from other areas. And what I sense now is a sense that it's like a localized masculinity and our masculinities. In Northern Ireland, that localization sometimes comes between two streets. Because in Northern Ireland, we've got peace walls, which is amazing. There's actually more peace walls now in a peace building society than what there was during the Troubles. But these were a street separates two different communities, and the behaviors are subtly, while they're different, and they have a lot of nuances, they're actually different, and the different way in which men grow and form with their. So I see masculinity as being something that's localized. So as I talk about masculinities now, if you're living in other parts of the world, maybe it's different. Maybe you don't see it or acknowledge it, or maybe men are more current. And there are communities where men would be seen as the curs and the emotional stability. But it's not our issue here. It's not the way we experience that. Now, we could say we aspire to more less like normative masculinity and the more sort of masculinity which is demonstrating who men are. And it embraces their identity, their beliefs, their values, their personality. Because see, at the end of the day, like when you pin it all back, you know, when we think of masculinity, or we think of femininity, or we think of other things, you know, they're all stereotypes. You know, really deep down, it's we talk about, but they're so powerful, and they're so powerfully embedded in society and communities, and even in my practice and in universities. And that doesn't mean that universities got it together. You know, there's people, I would say, they're gender blind. My colleague Susan Morgan and I, we developed this training model called the Lens Model, which is to help people think about how they practice gender. So you know, for instance, there's five rings in the lens, and the first one is understanding. This is for practitioners, but we can use it for in how we work as well. So understanding a gendered society. So we're saying the starting point is you need to take the gender blind glasses off and start seeing that gender impacts every aspect of our life, that all life is contested, and gender is a massive way in which life is contested. And then the second the ring we have is an appreciation of young people growing up within that and how they're impacted by that, and how, you know, stereotypes like masculinity and femininity shape behavior and can lead to, you know, issues around power. Then in the third ring we have the gendered self, which is how does gender affect me, or how does gender affect Sandy, or how does gender affect Stephen? You know, so you're reflecting on that. It's, and then the next thing is about, well, then how do we engage this issue? It's purposeful engagement. I mean, when I'm working, gender's all around me. I see it every day. And it's part of when I'm working with boys, their language or whatever. I'm so conscious of that. I would say, well, why would you say that? Why would you say that about that person when you don't? You know, so I'm always challenging that and behavior. And I realize now that boys, when you get to build a relationship with a boy and you get to know that boy, that they will begin to explore and question parts of their identity and parts of their behavior and parts of how maybe they are perpetrators or aggressors, or, you know, being sexist or whatever way that comes. And then the final part of that ring is transformation. We're looking to live in a society where people are transformed through their understanding of gender.
Yeah, with one thing I was wondering about, Ken, in terms of your work, is you've come up with this concept of gender-conscious relational pedagogy and the need to kind of embed this kind of understanding of masculinities as part of that to kind of transform the education that boys are receiving and the kind of what you, as you said, about the kind of compounded educational disadvantage they face. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by this kind of idea of gender-conscious relational pedagogy and what that involves in your eyes?
It's not a new concept, gender-conscious practice, but I think it's been something that's got around, but it's never really, you know, came to the fore in terms of thinking. Like, we have no strategy in Northern Ireland for being gender-conscious within formal education. So boys and girls grow up with no sort of real direction or insights out there. And, you know, I mean, our course at Ulster, we teach that. And we have done that for many, many years. But it's not standard throughout a university. It's not standard throughout schools and whatever. So, but what gender-conscious relational practice does, it puts the relationship between an educator and a learner at the centre of everything. It acknowledges that gender pervades every aspect of our lives and our culture. And it can provide very powerful notions about what it means to be a young man and a young woman, which near leads to how these people fulfill those roles. And a lot of that is based on stereotypes rather than who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I suppose, based on that and based on all of your experience, both in terms of practice and research, like, what would you say to kind of youth workers or teachers or counsellors about kind of practical ways to engage with boys and young men, perhaps especially in kind of conflict or post-conflict societies? And yeah, I mean, do you think there are things to learn from your experience in Northern Ireland in that regard as well?
You know, I think that what I believe I do is try to make things simple, you know, because in academia it's easy to get, sometimes you learn these big words and it makes it very easy to say that rather than tell people what the thing actually means. So when I think about working with boys, it isn't complex. It's challenging, it's difficult. You're wrestling with not knowing and you're trying to find out, so you're trying to get behind what you're being told to who the person is. I remember in university being told about this book, why I'm scared to tell you, why I'm afraid to tell you who I am. And you know what always stuck with me? And I think sometimes, you know, we carry a lot of deep insecurity, shame, things that we don't want anybody to know. So we create this private world, which we don't put out in public. And then in a university class, we were able very comfortably to bring that into a public setting where people can question that and reflect on that. And we do it with boys and young women as well. But if I was to say about the actual practice, what I'd say, how do you connect with boys? You know, as an educator, what is it you do that connects to boys, that gets boys talking? That was the first real, you know, I'd written things about boys, but the first publication really was that there was a booklet, was a Young Boys Talking, Voices in Belfast. And it was really saying that by talking, talk-based strategies, dialogue, conversation, that opens up a world of knowledge for me, from them boys coming to me. So it's how you connect to that there and engage and connect. I feel sometimes I may have the confidence not to go by what you feel you should say or what the situation that you're in, where you're near just relaxed enough to say to somebody, look at these boys, they're sitting there now looking at me, I don't know who on earth I am, but just asking a question that leads to another question, that leads to another question. And that's what I mean by connection, where you can actually, these boys begin to connect to you as an educator. It's just thinking that through and taking that sort of simple process in that can lead to deep, deep, deep conversations from that. I think creating spaces for boys to feel safe, learning spaces that they can enjoy, have fun, but they're learning through it. It's not complex. And the other wee saying is, part of the work I did in cross-community work, I always remember, this did with me my whole life, that, you know, it's better, you know, to light a candle than complain to the darkness. And your wee bit that you do, no matter how simple that is, can make such a difference. Because it only takes a spark to set. So that happened to me. It only takes a minute to change. You don't need a 12-week course or a 3-year programme. The change, it can happen in an instant, and sometimes just saying the right thing to the right boy at the right time can transform their lives. You may be the only person that's ever said something positive to that boy in a way that impacts upon them. So the approaches are very much like that. We don't avoid issues, we don't avoid hard issues, but we know we begin to try and put ourselves into the lives and realities of these boys and their lives and experiences, and that's what probably underpins the that's the non-academic way I would talk about that.
I was just going to say that we're approaching the end of our time, really, and I think all I'd say is just to thank Ken for, you know, giving us a really powerful insight into life in Northern Ireland, your own life, the life of the boys that you've been working with, and it just sounds so tremendous what you've been doing in such difficult circumstances. So I just wanted to thank you for talking to us today, and I'm sure it'll be absolutely fascinating for listeners as well.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for the invite there, just first of all for that there. I mean, you know, I was doing the podcast and since, how do you bring, you know, so many things in my own life over such a long period of time together, and so thank you for that opportunity, just for me and in my own head to talk through. It's not often maybe we get the opportunities in life, you know, as to do things like that. So thank you.
Oh, thanks.
It's an absolute pleasure to listen to you. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, what a fascinating interview that was, Stephen. I mean, I really noted his comment about the sort of, you know, generosity and kindness and humour of the people in Northern Ireland. And, you know, you have to set that alongside the incredible sort of period of violence that they went through and how they managed to come out the other side. And in the end, as he said, there's a message of hope in the Northern Ireland experience. There really is. And this was a riven society, and it is emerging, you know, in a sort of political transition, and there's a hell of a lot of work has been going on around peace building as well. I think he said that, you know, women have been particularly involved in that too, and you know, there's some really important stuff there that has wider echoes and resonance, I think. What did you make of it, Stephen?
Oh no, I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah, and it is that kind of contradiction, isn't it, or tension that on the one hand, like, actually, it isn't like perhaps we shouldn't immediately associate Northern Ireland with the Troubles and with all the violence that happened, because obviously there's so much more to it than that, and actually there is that big story of hope there. And actually, even if we're thinking about men and masculinities, there's all sorts of issues going on, some, you know, similar to other countries and some different. Mm. Like, as Ken himself mentioned, things like, you know, deindustrialization, the massive loss of jobs, industrial kind of jobs, post-industrialization, and what impacts that has on men and how men deal with that. But at the same time, of course, you know, the huge impact that you know, things like paramilitary organizing and the kind of the troubles, the impact that must have had on these constructions of masculinity and the impact they must continue to have, really, and how difficult it would be to live outside of that or to resist that or to try and do masculinity in a different kind of way, which did make me really interested in Ken himself as a person. And, you know, he didn't really talk about this, but I do think it must have been quite brave, quite risky for him to do what he did, you know, and to challenge these things, you know, through his own, you know, day-to-day practices and through his youth work as well. Yeah,
and there's some fascinating stuff in there about, you know, the work with boys and young men in particular, you know, and the whole sort of stereotype is that boys don't talk, you know, on an emotional level. And yet, you know, a large part of his life's work has been about making that happen and demonstrating in practice that boys can and do talk and that they've got quite a lot to say about their lives, you know, and we should, as the research heading says, take boys seriously, really, and take girls seriously too, of course, but you know, there has been an issue about, you know, reaching those boys, and I think there's quite a lot of messages in his work which would be helpful in that respect, so you know, hat tip for doing that, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he shows, doesn't he, that actually if you can create an environment where boys do feel safe and where they do feel like you're actually going to listen to them, then maybe they will start talking, even in these really tough, you know, quite brutalized environments sometimes. That, yeah, I suppose we need to look past these stereotypes we have about boys and actually really try and listen to them and what's going on with them.
And again, you know, in the context of the sort of normalizing of violence around them and, you know, distrust of the police and authority, you know, punishment, beatings or whatever, you know, all these things going on as well, and what that must do to, you know, boys, young men's sense of self as they grow up. How do they place themselves, really, you know, and what does it do to their mental health?
I suppose the other thing which comes to my mind as well is just, you know, I can't, as somebody from the UK, can't help but think about the impact of Brexit, which really has thrown a lot of these things into tension, hasn't it? And there's the renewed, you know, it's created a renewed risk, hasn't it, that there could be a real fallout, and there is a danger of a return to the past and an increase in violence and things like that. And you just can't help but think that British politicians and society more broadly, that I suppose we haven't taken seriously enough, I don't think, Northern Ireland, you know, and people's experiences there and the conflict there and you know, just, yeah, carelessly playing around with things like British nationalism and borders and our relationship with the European Union without really thinking about the implications of that for Northern Ireland and the people there and with these issues of militarism and so on.
Yeah, but also fascinating in terms of things like social issues as well. So, as I understand it, abortion is now, you know, possible in Northern Ireland. You know, only in the last recent period has that become the case. Before that, you know, young women were flying to Luton Airport in the UK, going to, you know, British Pregnancy Advisory Service in London and flying back again. You know, so you have a sense of sort of social attitudes in transition alongside political and economic change as well. And of course, changes which we've discussed before with Shay going on in Southern Ireland around that too. So, fascinating melting pot and a sense of hope, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And it does make you think as well, doesn't it? Some connections with our previous episodes, like even the last one with Jocelyn Smith-Lee, like the in terms of young men growing up in environments where violence is so normalised.
And also Raywin Connell's early work on boys in school, you know, which she talked about in our interview with her, which seems many moons ago now, but
it does,
but
doesn't it?
You know, very very relevant really, and some real correspondence with this work.
Yeah,
that's probably
as
enough
we
from
enter
us.
Our 40th episode. I think that probably is enough for today. Yes, but yes, we'll speak to you again soon, there, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. As always, do contact us at nowmen@gmail.com if you have questions or feedback. And subscribe if you haven't done so already. And please do share it with your friends and family and colleagues. And take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye.